closer.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I am your host for today. And as always, it's going to be an exciting day for the podcast. It always is, kind of. It's a crazy year. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Just got back from a trip where I gave a bunch of big speeches to, like, not that my speech was big. It's pretty much the same crap always. No, to big rooms of people, so that's fun. And getting all excited for the class that we're going to have in Vegas that's coming up in March. And it's crowded and going to be fun on advanced learning. And, you know, the normal stuff, traveling back and forth. The winter seems, at least, I don't know what it's like for you guys, but for those of us in the American Southwest where I am, it seems like it's not a winter. I mean, here we are encroaching past February into beautiful March and kind of not much action so far. Although in New Mexico where I am, our snowiest months usually are pretty much April and May. And May's kind of a ripoff because in May you're really ready for winter to be over and then it snows a lot and I don't know. It would be charming in December and entertaining in January and appropriate in February, but in May it's just kind of insulting. It just seems like, will this ever end? Who knows? Lots of interesting feedback on my airline story. Thank you for all your comments. Who knows what'll happen to me at airports? It's crazy and it's getting worse. You know, I have problems with authority. I've always kind of had problems with authority. That's my deal. And I really don't like rules that are stupid. Like, for instance, I think things that are stupid are just, I don't know what, I guess to repeat myself, stupid. And so that's kind of part of where this process is. Other than that, man, there's so much to talk about. You'll hear lots more interesting and amazing pieces of data. There's a really interesting opportunity that's coming up. Actually, by now, I'll bet we've already talked about it, but it looks like we're going to have an open day with Sydney Decker and myself just to kind of hang out and have conversation. And we're inviting people to it. But I'll talk to you more about that as I have details. I don't have any details right now, so I don't know what's going on. It's crazy. It's like coordinating the largest prom for the most people with no control over anything. That's how pretty much this story of my life is all the time anyway. So what else? Today's podcast. Well, so I'm really fixated on a bunch of stuff. I'm fixated on the difference between the word prediction and prevention. I'm really interested in pre-job training. Pre-job meetings, pre-job assessments, JTAs, whatever you guys call them. I'm interested in how they don't really serve as a prevention tool, but they are a prediction tool. But what they really are is sort of increased capacity. And so I had a chance the other day to sit down with Mark Yeston, who I think is an expert. I don't think this. I actually know this. Is an expert in the notion of pre-job briefs and how to use them really in a very predictive way to manage systems and defenses to actually create work that happens safely in a varying environment with lots and lots of risk. That sounded fancy. I should type that, actually. Anyway, Mark, we sat down. We were hanging out, and we sat down, and I asked him a question. And the question I asked him, actually, was how should leaders think about a pre-job brief? Not how do workers think about a pre-job brief. I think we've talked about that a bunch. But how should leaders think about them? What do they need to be thinking in order to make this happen? And that's kind of what the podcast is going to cover. It's really interesting. It starts a little. Mark was in the process of telling me a story, and I had the recorder there, so I turned the recorder on, and he's going to talk about a story that I actually found really, really interesting. So sit back and relax. I think you'll find this podcast to be very, very interesting. I certainly did. This is Mark Yeston and really leadership's role with pre-job briefing. So here we go. This is the podcast.
Ended up needing to get extricated from a ditch. So really, really good worker. Like, this is the guy that you send out when you really need to get something done. And the only bad thing about it is part of his job is driving to the job. And he has 3 or 4 accidents in the past year.
Do you think he considers... So I always wonder this. Does he consider the part where you drive to the job?
I think after the first wreck...
Well, no, I think management considers it.
Right, right.
Well, probably retrospectively, but I think management considers it a job. But does the worker, does the really good guy, is that work or is that what you do in order to go and do work?
That's getting to work, yeah. That's going to work to start the work. So
I didn't mean to interrupt, sorry.
No, no. So the supervisor and the management are like, you know, God, you know, what can we do? You know, we can't suffer this vehicle damage because every time we have vehicle damage, that's seen as like, you know, pointing to there's a weakness in our operations and people aren't caring enough and they're not taking care of the equipment or being reckless or worse, maybe they're even drunk or intoxicated or something like that. And so each one of these things prompts a drug test, a kind of a law enforcement interview, get the cops involved, you know, to investigate the accident because of insurance and liability concerns. And, of course, the blood test comes out fine or the breath test or whatever. There's no sign of intoxication. And we're just sort of left with, well, maybe this person's just a bad driver, a really good employee, but a bad driver. And he manages to go for about 6 months without having an incident. And then on this one particular day, a rare day for him when he's actually has a passenger, and he's driving, you know, carefully and slowly on kind of a, you know, back out on the oiled patch, unpaved road. And all of a sudden, the passenger gets the sense that something's going wrong with the car. And he looks over, and the driver is unconscious and having a seizure. They go off the road. They stop. No injuries. A little bit of damage to the vehicle. You know, when the driver kind of comes to, he says, "My God, you know what? What happened? Are you okay?" He says, "You know, this has happened to me a couple of times, and every time it happens to me, I think it's going to be the last time. Please don't tell anybody, because if they know I'm having this problem, they're going to fire me. There's no way I'm going to be able to keep my job."
God, that took a turn. I wasn't thinking it would. Yeah. I thought that this was going to be an easy question.
He wasn't a bad driver. He had a seizure disorder.
So it was really a worker health issue.
A worker health issue.
Probably pretty important to identify.
And perhaps even treatable. You know, he'd had some adjustments and medications for other problems and, you know, other medical history and stuff like that, that, you know, but this could have been a manageable problem, but the worker did not feel that they could come for the worker in the aftermath of it. Once, you know, was observed having a seizure, it was obvious that, management, if they were aware of it, would have the way they reacted to it would be very, very important. It would also inform future employees as to how, you know,
oh yeah, because
honest, they were going to.
Because what management would say is you're on driving restrictions, which for this guy means he couldn't do his work,
right?
Which he was super good at, and the organization relied on him doing it.
And his work is high value, high skilled enough, and requires licensing and certification and currency and stuff like that. That really, you know, getting to the job was kind of incidental, and the workaround until they, I think in this instance, they did a nice job. And of course, they couldn't let him drive, and they had to, you know, basically do a fitness for duty around the ability to drive, should he even be licensed in the state that, you know, where this occurred. But he was a valuable enough worker that they made an accommodation to get him basically chauffeured to his work site.
How old was he?
Give him an extra hand. He was young. He's in his 40s. Could I say young in 40s?
No, I think that
really?
Now the courts are going to come and
really
find us.
Yeah.
Because that also then totally impugns that you're super old.
Been
just a young buck.
Been shaven for a couple weeks anyway.
A whippersnapper.
Yeah.
A whippersnapper. Gosh, wow, that's so interesting to hear that story just because it just shows the power of workplace culture, the power of fear. But what it really illustrates to me is that I had so biased that story. I did not think it was going to go.
And in the wrecks that preceded it, you know, there was counseling. Are you you know, you don't rush to get to the job.
Yeah,
you know,
take your time.
Make sure, you know, check the brakes.
Both hands on the wheel.
That's right. Yeah. And they cycled him through defensive driving online training several times.
Yeah, he could probably teach Smith driving because he's taken it 90 times.
Teach it backwards, you know. And he had a medical issue, but he wasn't feeling comfortable telling anyone. And I think honestly remain confident that, you know, like we all do when we have something.
Sure,
going,
last
like,
time.
Oh, this cold will be short-lived, or this must just be because I changed my blood pressure medication or such thing, and this will go away.
And that power of denial, I mean, you can couple that with gender. I mean, there's a real bias towards not showing weakness in this case. And then if you grew up like I did, where there's no value at all at being sick.
Right.
So, like, when I was sick and would say, "Mom, I don't feel good," she would say, "Get up and go to school. Not feeling good."
Right.
I mean, that's what you... How... I mean, this is a really good intro into the question I'm dying to ask you. We talk a lot about pre-job as sort of a capacity builder. I mean, I think that's a relatively new idea, but it's the right idea, and I think companies that are doing it really see it as a capacity builder. I was just on the phone with the Potash guys yesterday, and they were talking about how once they started looking at their pre-job brief as a capacity tool, it changed the way they did their pre-job briefs. And I think we have a pretty good handle on how workers should look at pre-job briefs. How should managers think of pre-job brief? How do we get managers to shift their thinking away from an administrative task that must be done before a weaponized tool that can be used retrospectively? How do we move them into an area where they think of pre-jobs differently?
Yeah, I'm more and more starting to picture it like the plank on a ship. You know, walk the plank. You know, that plank is like the black line. And then at a certain point, either, you know, willingly or not, you're going to have to take the plunge. Wouldn't it be nice if you could nail a little extra material onto that plank and buy some time and try to figure out, you know, maybe we don't have to take this plunge, or we could take it in a place that isn't shark infested, or make it a little bit safer.
So can you do this entire conversation with only pirate metaphors?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's try.
I just rewatched Pirates of the Caribbean. I can't.
Arg.
So, but you, that black line, the prescription, and really the kind of the almost very pointy end of the black line, kind of using the sharp end of the stick. Now, the point of the black line is that are those, you know, still printed JSAs and checklists and things like that, all really, really good that we need, but it's the organic conversation that takes place as they're standing there on the precipice, you know, about to encounter the kind of non-recoverable things that might happen, that allows them to identify places where we need some resilience and capacity. Because those situations are always just slightly different than imagined. Even on the freshest, you know, JHA that a committee worked on and everybody's discussed and come to consensus on, taking it out into the field gets you only so far.
So what's the conversation you have with leaders on that? I mean, because I think workers, that's a really good way to think of pre-job for the worker. But how do leaders understand that differently? Because I think we have to get leaders to see it as a different type of tool, for it to fully become a different type of tool, for it to not have the retrospective power that it has to be weaponized.
Well, one thing is documentation of it. And so if you compel people to, you know, do that last moment conversation and then go back and then document it on whatever, you know, physical job planning tool they have, then you basically put it back in that weaponized category.
But don't I have to have documentation?
You do have to have good documentation.
OSHA, MSHA for sure. The mining people would really.
And that's where that JHA and the formalized conversation and the PPE checks and, you know, the lockout tag and all that stuff is going to get us there. But if we look at that, if we capture the results of the conversation that we have right before we dive into the work, and the documentation of that takes place as a post-job learning, you know, how did it go kind of thing, then it's not something that's been written before the job took place, and it's not something that anyone can go back to. So we're going to document, like, I'm going to put a net here, I'm going to, you know, lock this out, I'm going to come back when the weather conditions are better, you know, whatever those things are. But when the work concludes, I think that's when you go back and document that. Those crew conversations, independent of the, you know, documented forms and everything like that, to facilitate kind of additional learning, and you're going to figure out some more stuff out there anyway. I think encouraging, you know, some post job documentation is great, and it's documented because then it retrospectively reflects reality as it was encountered and as they were successful or as they had to make adjustments.
God, that's a really interesting idea. So you're saying the documentation part of the pre-job is actually the post-job activity. So instead of documenting what they're going to do, they actually document what they actually did.
I mean, we have to document what we're going to do to a certain point.
Right.
Right, and that's just good practice. But, you know, when we're up, you know, in the work, and we're having those last conversations, we're up in the bucket, or we're up the ladder, or we're down the hole, or wherever, that's where that small crew is going to have that, hey, I didn't expect to see this here. What are we going to do about it? How are we going to make this safe?
What's the difference between prevention and prediction? Because is the pre-job tool a prediction tool or a prevention tool? Or first of all, is there a difference? Let me. Tomato.
Tomato. Yeah.
Potato.
Prediction or prevention? Well, I think, you know, you don't really put in a prevention or a capacity or a defense until you've done some work to kind of predict what that outcome might be. You know, what are the things that can happen? What are we not seeing here? You know, what can bite us? You know, good crew communication, even with that most junior person who has hopefully been culturally made aware within that work unit that their insight is valuable and that they're going to be listened to and their concerns are going to be addressed.
So prediction is a precursor to prevention?
I'd say, you know, I think one of our greatest capacities is the ability to run simulations, to look at the setting and look at the goal and objective and kind of run a mental simulation. Because, we could, you know, if somebody calls us up all of a sudden, how long do you think that's going to take? That's going to require us to run a mental simulation.
Yeah, which is super high functioning. Humans are quite good at it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we simulate all the time. We simulate all the time while we're driving.
Right.
We're in Vegas right now. Actually, in a room that overlooks the Bellagio fountains. Not that I'm bragging.
That's pretty
cool. That's where we are. And you run simulations in your head probably every time you walk by a slot machine, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you're thinking this could be it, baby. So prediction really is precursive to prevention.
I think, well, in my mind, you run the simulation, you have the discussion, or if it's just a solo worker, you're running that simulation consciously or unconsciously about what is this going to mean, what am I going to need to do it, and then you adapt. You adapt the situation, then as you encounter, you know, unexpected changes in the situation, you have to modify your simulation. And that's the difference between, because all of that black line work leading up to that point, that planning, based on reality and based on post-job learning from the past or based on mishaps or accident, is still, at its essence, a simulation, a human simulation that can never be 100% specific.
And when you modify the simulation, you're really changing performance modes, right? I mean, so
absolutely,
that's a good indicator of a performance mode jump. So how does a leader interface with this? Because I'm not saying you're dodging the question, but I'm not getting an answer. How should leaders think about the pre-job?
Well, I think that leaders often think of the pre-job as that institutionalized tool that, you know, boy, they better not go out there without having this thing checked off. And there's a lot of good stuff on there, you know, PPE and, you know, compliance and procedures and the capacities that we know we need to throw into a job based on past experiences. But I think the best thing a leader can do is let people understand that, you know, that's the best laid plan, and the best laid plan seldom, even though it gets us really, really close to the reality that's going to be encountered, is seldom complete. And it's those gaps that the management wants to know about. That once you go out there and use this tool, this which is the best we can give you, and find that you have to, you know, hang some decoration on it or make some changes, or there are pieces to it that don't work, that there needs to be a feedback so that it's a living thing and not just a, you know.
So is it valuable for a leader to go out and look at a pre-job?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you want them to look for?
Well, I think mere presence is a huge issue. You know, I mean, it's hard to find a worker who, you know, tells you, like, you know, well, you know, Bob did it 20 years ago, but it ain't nothing like it was 20 years ago. And if Bob's not out there looking at the job, and I don't mean Bob Edwards, another Bob, yeah.
Let's call him Bob.
Yes. Presence on the job site is huge. And it's, and you know, I've been a manager, I've been a leader, and sometimes, you know, you're spending so much of your time just, you know, getting ready to do the work and doing all of the minutiae and the budgeting and everything else like that. It is hard to get out. You have to force yourself to get out. And when you go out, you have your bosses in the organization heaping all kinds of work on there, and every time you go out and interact with the people whose hopes and dreams depend on you, you control the purse strings, you control the schedule, you control work environments and things like that. It can be, people can often be reluctant to do that because you've already got enough work. So why go out to these people who you know you're surely going to disappoint because you can't say, hey, everybody gets a company car and new gold teeth and, you know, I can, you know, I have an unlimited budget and I can make all these dreams come true. And so some of us are reluctant to go out there because we know we're going to come back with extra work. But I think if you go out and often enough, people understand that you are there to do the best you can with the resources that you have and that they will be listened to and that sometimes the answer is not always yes.
But it's that shift between seeing pre-job. Traditionally, I think we saw pre-job as a barrier, as a protection, and it's not. So I'll just say it. A pre-job briefing, a pre-job task analysis in the field is not a control. It is, however, additional footage on the plank to keep our pie metaphor going.
Yes.
It is a capacity builder. It builds capacity. It builds space. It gives the worker more time to think and more time to simulate.
Right.
Fair enough?
Right. And they can plan and they can simulate as right as they're about to touch the work. Because once you start getting involved in the work, that space for planning and simulating really diminishes.
Are you seeing pre-job briefing concepts change? Are they changing?
I think so. I think in organizations where the workers who are performing the work recognize that there's a value to what they're learning out there to their supervisors and managers, and the supervisors and managers are expecting that, then they feel part of like a closed, you know, loop process, and they're constantly improving the situation.
Are they worth doing?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, they cost nothing. They don't take any time at all, and the simpler, the better. And you know, crews that are really good at this have developed among themselves or borrowed from other places some questions that they're going to ask themselves, you know, before that work commences. You know, okay, so we've gone through our checklist, we've finished this off, and now we're about to start. We have a really good picture of how we think this is going to go. Here's my picture of what I think. Here's what I think we're going to do. Here's how long I think it's going to take. Here are the things that I think are going to, you know, be of concern that might bite us that we need to put in a little capacity. What do you think? And that's where good leadership and management gives those other employees the space to speak up.
And at the risk of sounding a little defeatist, worrying about the pre-job as a documentation for future liability is ridiculous, because every single case I've ever worked on, in retrospect, the pre-job was insufficient because what happened during the work was not noted in the pre-job. And so the fear of future liability keeping us from changing or experimenting or making these documents living, that fear is kind of stupid.
Yes.
Because the consequence is there if failure happens anyway.
Right.
Fair enough?
Yeah, absolutely.
Final words on this?
No, I think a lot of people are having these really good conversations, and I think it's helping to allow them to feel that management cares, that their supervisors
right.
care, that their feedback. I mean, they're the probes. They're going out into the invisible part of the job and coming back with intelligence that only they have because they laid their hands on it. And when that's appreciated, it sets up a culture where people feel able to safely share information, even if it's going to challenge the status quo or require some sort of, you know, intervention or expense even. And it maybe sets them up to feel safer to just be honest about things that are happening so that we don't have folks that are, you know, crashing cars 3, 4, 5, 6 times before they finally, you know, can come forward and say, you know, I've got a medical issue. It's not just that I'm a bad driver. Can you help me out with that?
Yeah.
And when the company is in a position to help out with that, that sends a huge message to the rest of the workers.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
So that's the podcast. What do you think? Super interesting. I mean, the whole story at the beginning where they had a series of vehicle strikes, vehicle accidents, and their response was to manage it really through improving the workers' behavior as if vehicle strikes were a choice, and for them to discover that in fact it was a pretty significant fitness for duty issue changes the calculus. And that's kind of an interesting way to start this story. I mean, it really that had impact on me. And then for Mark to talk about really how they look at and understand pre-job briefing and how it really is a way to actually manage capacity, a way to create time. And that time, that thinking time that workers do, that's a pretty important time because they're going to meet variability. There's going to be variance in the work they're going to do, and they're going to have to simulate that idea. And the fact that adults, really people, I think kids do this even better, but the fact that human beings have the ability to run simulations in real time and then determine sort of responses based on those simulations, that's not necessarily new news for us. We've known that a long time, but it's important news, and I think it's kind of new to the safety people. That's what happens. It's a great podcast. I mean, this is a thoughtful one. You might listen to it a couple times. As always, thanks for listening. Tell your friends, and if you get a chance, write a review, but only write good ones. Don't write crappy ones. I got plenty of those. And keep listening, and let's see if we can grow this even larger. I'm super excited with where everything is on this podcast, and I owe a lot of that to you. Until then, learn something new every – well, I hope you get what you want. I hope everybody gets what they want. And learn something new every single day. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes – be safe. And this podcast is brought to you by one of my very, very, very favorite works of published narrative, of written narrative. One of my favorite things to read in the whole world, the American Constitution. I can't support the American Constitution enough, and I ask you to make it your favorite document as well. If you're interested, go to ACLU.com.